I mean, the
today is Wednesday.
The
end of June.
The 30th of June.
It may be the 29th. Shall I look it up?
No, that's all right. That's fine.
I have a calendar in
the
kitchen.
I'll make sure I double check it. And I'm Natalie Peters. I'm here with Rosa Crocker. And we're just going to talk about Harvard County History 1994. Okay. Okay. And what's brought you to Harvard County? What's that there?
I married a Harvard Countyan.
Mm-hmm. And that would be Michael Crocker?
Michael Pugh Crocker. And I was welcomed here by all of his relatives and friends. Most of them were, everybody was lovely to me when I came here. And I arrived with a ready-made set of friends and relatives.
Tell me how you met your husband.
My father was the track coach at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. And I grew up watching boys run around the track and put the shot and throw the javelin and hurdle and everything. My husband was on the team from 1936 to 1940, so he was one of the track boys.
And then you met him there, and were you also attending Washington Lee? Or?
No, there were no girls there then.
Oh, that's right. No, of course not. I stand corrected. Did you attend a university?
I went to Vassar College. I'm 2 years younger than my husband.
And then you came to Harford County in what year?
We were married in 1945, even before World War II was quite over. And the atom bomb dropped, the war ended. My husband was in the Pacific Theater with the Marines. And as soon as the war was over, he entered the University of Virginia Law School. He had had a year of night law school before the war, and he was eager to finish. So, we were married and went to law school together in Charlottesville. And as soon as he graduated, which was 2.5 years later, we moved to Baltimore, lived in an apartment on Park Avenue. He got a job at the law firm of Marbury, Miller, and Evans, which later became Piper and Marbury. And he stayed with them for 37 years.
And what were you doing at the time when you moved to Baltimore? Did you have children at that time? Or?
No, because we had just been married. And in those days, you didn't have children before you were married.
No, of course not.
Most people didn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's so different now.
Tell me about some of those changes.
Some of them are good. Some are not. I think women have many more opportunities now than they did, and so do black people. And other minorities, many more opportunities, and are not looked down on. We did not, when I was growing up in Virginia, we did not look down on black people at all, but we recognized that they didn't have as much education, and they mostly earned their living by manual labor. Now, their opportunities are so greatly increased, and it's just wonderful. And that may seem like a long time to you, but it really isn't.
And what other changes have you seen since
in Harford County?
Overall, since your first time coming to this area, Baltimore area too? What was Baltimore like when you first moved there?
To me, I remember thinking, Baltimore is a city that is resting on its laurels. It had a very wonderful past history. Lots of great things had happened there. Not to mention the fact that it was a real social center, as well as economic, agricultural, trade, commerce, education, a center for educational institutions. But it was it was sitting there resting on its laurels to me as an outside observer. But it very shortly started to change and is still doing that. Many improvements have been made. Not only just the physical improvements around the Inner Harbor as a perfect example of lots of better things, but coming into the 20th century, you might say, looking to the future, paying attention to what's going on now and what people need now to live, instead of just dwelling on the past. I was a history major in college, so was my husband, and so was our daughter Virginia. So we're really into history. But I admired my mother so much because one of her characteristics was she did not live in the past, and she lived to be almost 94 years old. She was always up to date, thinking about how things are now, what people need to do to solve their problems, how to improve their lives. That's one reason so many young people liked her, because she was interested in what they were doing, very much so, and they all enjoyed being with her. I really admired that in her.
Can you describe what Baltimore was like when you first came here? What were the things that you remember most, the physical features?
Well, having grown up in a small town in Virginia, it was the first major city I had lived in, not counting my wartime service in San Francisco.
I'd like to hear about that too.
And wartime service in Washington, D.C. That was, I had two war jobs. I was not in military service. I applied but was turned down. They told me that my civilian job was so important that they would not release me to join the military service.
And what was your civilian job?
I was a code clerk for the Army Air Force. It was called then Army Air Corps.
My grandfather was a colonel.
And my job was to encode and decode secret and confidential messages for that branch of the Air Corps, which was known as the Air Transport Command. And they transported personnel, cargo, mail, and planes. They ferried them.
How did you get that position? How did you first get interested?
Oh, everybody was helping with the war effort the minute it started. Everybody just figured out as fast as possible what he could do to help the war effort. And that's why we won, because we pulled together and we didn't give up. And we had a wonderful leader in Franklin Roosevelt. I just applied and was accepted. And I worked at Gravelly Point, which is the national airport in Washington, and then was sent to the station at Hamilton Field outside of San Francisco. From there, we took care of messages going down into the South Pacific for planes, cargo, mail, and personnel.
And how long were you in San Francisco?
About a year. I lived in San Rafael. One of the exciting things that happened while I was working there, have you ever heard of Captain Eddie Rickenbacker?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was downed at sea with his crew. And when he was finally rescued, they floated around in the ocean for, maybe 3 weeks or a long time. Some of them died. He was rescued and brought back to our airfield. And I was on duty when he arrived and looked out the window and saw them unloading that plane with him and his crew. Captain Rickenbacker walked off of that plane holding his head high, even though he was in terrible physical condition. But he was the leader, and he walked on. The others were carried on stretchers, or limped, or on crutches, or something like that. Not Rickenbacker. That was inspiring. It really was. Then I was sent to Gravely Point.
In Washington.
In Washington, that's right. And there, of course, our the messages that we were sending from our code room involved the air traffic to the European theater, Newfoundland, England, and so forth.
And this was about 1941?
No.
1942?
We didn't end the war until December 7th, 1941. It was in 42 and 43. And after about 2 years of that job, I changed to the American Red Cross Hospital Recreation Service. That involved being trained in Alexandria and being sent to, they sent me back to California. I worked at Camp Roberts, California, which was an infantry replacement training center. My uncle, who was in the Army, had been commander of that base very shortly before I got there, so I didn't have the advantage of having an uncle as a commander. I just had to. I was sorry. Our job was to provide hospital recreation for the patients, who were an amazing mix. We had Italian prisoners of war who were so happy to be there. They just loved being prisoners of war because they had a safe bed and good food and easy work. They shipped them out in trucks every day to the firing range, and they had to clean up the police up the area and do things like that. But it was not anything like hard labor, and they were safe from the war. They were so glad to stop fighting. That was one group. But the majority of the men there, and they were mostly men, although there were some women in the Women's Army Corps and nurses, were training for infantry replacement assignment. So that was men taking the basic training, and women, some women too. Then another group, entirely different, were the veterans, the old soldiers coming back from the Pacific who had been at war over there for many months, sometimes years. They all looked yellow, not because they had taken on Oriental cast, but because they had to take Adabrin to prevent, what does Adabrin prevent? Yellow fever or malaria, one of those tropical diseases.
Now, these men weren't really that much older than the men that were going.
No, not physically. Not physically, but they had been to war, and the others were just marching around learning how to turn right and left and make up their beds and shoot their guns. Quite different.
Did these men interact with one another?
I don't know too much. They were certainly not. Their assignments were not together. So,
do you remember any individuals from that? Any special people that stood
in out? My photograph album, I have pictures. Mm-hmm. Sure do.
So you made some friends with the people coming through and there.
Not permanent friends, no. But she certainly felt a great admiration for these people and desire to do anything you could to ease their life. That's what the Red Cross was for. And my job was hospital recreation. So we showed movies, and sometimes we would write letters for people who were bedbound. Or we'd go shopping for them at the PX because their girl was coming and they wanted to have a box of candy for her. That seems
trivial, but nothing was trivial for them. Anything that would help them get well and raise their morale, that was our top goal.
Tell me about writing those letters. That must have been quite an experience.
Well, I can't remember many details. And if they couldn't write, you know, they still wanted a letter to go home.
Do you remember if that was ever really difficult for you?
No.
What they had to say must have been.
Not at all. Mm-hmm. You just did whatever you could for them. Mm-hmm. But that's a good question. It could have been.
So then you came back to the East Coast after that, after your time in California. And
my mother wrote to me. My father had had a stroke. And my mother wrote to me and she said, if you want to see your father again, get yourself transferred east. So I did, and was stationed next and last at McGuire General Hospital outside of Richmond, Virginia. And that was an entirely different setup. The patients at McGuire were battle casualties from Europe. They had been brought in by a hospital ship and unloaded in Norfolk and transferred to hospital trains and shipped straight from Norfolk to Richmond, a very easy, quick trip. So our hospital had two specialties. That was, we had orthopedic cases and neurologic cases. So the place was swarming with people walking around on crutches with casts and, you know, on their arms and legs and everything, and then plates in their heads. If they had had serious brain injuries, they would put plates in their heads. They, I think, were the bravest men I've ever met, because they bucked each other up. They were all there together. They had this common experience. They joked and teased each other, and I think that was a typical military way for them to get along. And what we had to do was so small by comparison to what they had done. So it was a real privilege to be able to be in a setting like that and to be any help at all. We played games with them, cards, you know, whatever they wanted to do. I remember I was at the front desk of the Red Cross wing, and I heard a very deep voice at my elbow say, I was sitting there holding the phone, waiting for Ward 17 or something to answer to say whether they wanted me to bring them a movie that afternoon. And this voice said, what's the matter, honey? Won't he answer? And it was Walter Pidgeon, who had come there to put on a show of some sort.
Did you have a conversation with him? Or?
Sure.
And you recognized him immediately?
Right. At Camp Roberts, California, I was in a soldier's show, Girl Crazy, by Gershwin. And the lead was taken by Red Skelton, who was taking his basic training at Camp Roberts at that time. And he was one good sport. He came to rehearsal on time. He never gave any back talk to the director. He just did it and did it well. And every night, the show ran for 10 nights. Every night, his jokes were different. He was so clever, so that the cast was broken up, as well as the audience. You can imagine. Mm-hmm.
Did you get to know him more so outside the...
No. It wasn't time. So then, but that was fun.
Yeah. It sounds like it. After your time at Richmond, then what happened?
My husband came home from the Pacific, and we decided to get married, and we were married. Well, the Iwo Jima campaign was his last. That was in February. He came home in May. We were married in June, with the expectation that he would have 1 month's leave at home after having been overseas for over 3 years. He was to go back to be in the force that was designed to invade the mainland of Japan. That was going to be the final blow, the final strike to close out this miserable business. And that's what they were planning for. He didn't have to do that after all, because Harry Truman dropped the bomb.
Tell me about that. Tell me what it was like for you all to hear about the news of the bomb drop.
Well, it was a closely kept secret, and it was totally unexpected. Not only was it a bomb, but it was an atom bomb. No, there hadn't been any before, certainly not used in combat. I can't remember whether we knew that they were being tested or not. I was not aware that it was being developed or tested. You know, when the headlines of the paper, which were mile high, atom bomb dropped. Was it Hiroshima or Nagasaki first? It was Hiroshima first. Right. People walked around the streets. We were living in Fredericksburg, Virginia at the time. He was stationed at Quantico, being retrained to go back to the Pacific. And people just wandered around the streets, just jubilant, solemn, both, you know, couldn't believe the news, but overjoyed. Now, Japan didn't give up with the bomb on Hiroshima. The next bomb was therefore dropped a week later on Nagasaki, and then they gave up. And high time, after all the damage they had done, all the misery they had caused, all the casualties. The younger generation who doesn't live through this doesn't remember what it really was like. But I have talked with my children, our children and their friends from time to time. They emphasize how terrible it was to drop the atom bomb on those innocent people. Well, it was terrible. But we had to stop that war. We had to stop those Japanese from trying to conquer the world. You would have done the same thing, I'm sure. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I certainly did. So tell me what that week was like between the bombs. Do you remember?
No.
Just that feeling of jubilation and sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And then your husband would have gotten the news that he didn't have to go back.
Right. It was almost immediately decided that, anybody who wanted to be discharged could be. And he chose that right away. And this was August, and law school started in September.
And he enrolled for that?
University of Virginia, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And then what did you do at that time?
I applied for another job and was employed as a secretary to the Dean of Counseling. That was interesting because many of the students who came through our office were discharged veterans, wanting to go back to school under the GI Bill, which was a tremendous thing. It made it possible for all the returning soldiers who wanted to continue and complete their education to do so. I think it was one of the finest, most imaginative acts of Congress that I have ever known about. It just changed the lives of millions of young men and women who might have been at a terrible loss, you know, suddenly back on the job market, and there were an awful lot of them. So that was a very creative piece of legislation, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Fitting piece of legislation.
I know.
And then after that, your husband...
After he graduated, then we came to Baltimore. He had an interview at a firm in Baltimore. He went for an interview in West Virginia and one or two other places. But he decided to accept the offer from Marbury, Miller, and Evans law firm in Baltimore.
Do you remember your first impression of Baltimore when you first came there?
It needed paint. It needed cleaning up. So much depends on where you're looking from. I was looking from the point of view of a young married woman who was new to the area. I knew some of the glories of their institutions like Johns Hopkins and Peabody and so forth. My mother had gone to Johns Hopkins Hospital Nursing School before World War I. What do you think of that? Isn't that amazing? And learned a lot. She didn't graduate, but she learned a lot. Well, girls weren't doing that sort of thing very much in those days, especially coming from another state. Mm-hmm. And she was from the sort of family where she would ordinarily have been expected to make her debut and get married. She didn't make her debut, but she did get married, and she married a Yankee.
What a scandal.
He was from Chicago. And she lived in Lexington, Virginia with her family, and my father came there on the physical education faculty and was the track coach. And he was very attractive, and he was different. He wasn't one of these slow-moving, slow-talking Southern gentlemen. He was a doer from Notre Dame University and had been on the American Olympic team in 1912. So I asked her how she met him. She was quite a belle, I gather, from hearing people talk. She said, well, one afternoon, he invited me one Sunday afternoon to go for a buggy ride. That's how one way you entertained your girl. And I said, where did you go? She said, well, I asked him to drive past Jenny Hopkins' house. I said, who was Jenny Hopkins? Was one of my mother's best friends. Because my father had taken Jenny out before that. And then mother said, and he didn't take her out anymore after that.
Your mother sounds like a very clever woman. So what was it like being a young married couple in Baltimore when you first came there? What did you do?
Well, my husband walked to work. It was 10 or 12 blocks, I would say. I got a job at the University of Maryland Medical School with an obstetrician, a woman obstetrician, who spent most of her time delivering babies from poor families in the neighborhood of the hospital. I remember interviewing one young pregnant woman, asking her the required questions such as, your age, how many children do you have? And the father. And this one woman, young woman, said, I got four children. One by my first husband. Two by the man I'm living with now. And one of my own. That's on the record. So that's what she said. One day, one of the other gals who worked in our office came running in and she said, you always said you wanted to observe a delivery. There's one about to happen now over in delivery room number so-and-so. And they said that if you put on a mask and gown, you can come. Well, I was just dying to go. I'd never seen that. And working there, you know, would make you interested. But my boss said, I'm sorry, but I've got to get these letters out before the day closes, and I'm sorry. So I didn't get to go. That's all right.
So you never did see a delivery there?
No.
That must have been an interesting position, though, anyway.
Well, she was a wonderful person. Her name was Margaret Ballard. She was about 5 feet tall, I'm sure, no more than that.
It was unusual to have female obstetricians at that time, wasn't it?
Well,
they weren't that common.
The war was a big turning point for women. There's no question about that. They had to do all kinds of things that they had never done before to get the job done, to get the war won. Rosie the Riveter is a prototype. And females in the armed services, you see, that was a big new thing. There'd always been nurses, but the women's.
Your observations on how the war changed things for women?
Changed them a lot, I think. I grew up in a small college town with a very close-knit family and circle of friends as a faculty child, which gives you a sense that, you know, a sense of security. And you know who you are and everybody else. You know who everybody else is and they know who you are. And you can't get away with much because they know you. But on this, by the same token, it gives added stability to your life and security, emotional security. Well, the war just turned everything topsy-turvy. People, first thing of all happened, people moved away. They moved to where the war plants were. They joined the service. They went overseas. They went across the country, back and forth and up and down. And mobilizing to win this war, that was on everybody's mind. Unconditional defeat was our goal of Hitler and Japan, and we were absolutely determined to do that. There was very, very little disagreement, and that's one of the reasons it was so successful. It was tremendously hard work, it was horribly expensive in money and lives, but, you know, we did it. And therefore, having experienced that, we find it hard to understand how younger people who have not had the same point of view don't seem to share that understanding or determination. So I'm glad to have a chance to say there was a great unity in the country, I think.
Tell me what your response to the deterioration of that unity, say Vietnam, 20 years later. What was your response and your observation on that?
Well, I can remember thinking people were very, very bitterly and clearly divided on whether we should be there in the first place. What business was it of ours to go over there and do that? Was, you know, one point of view. But the other point of view was, we have got to defeat communism wherever it is. It was no joke. It was a very serious worldwide threat. And some people felt, and the ones who got us into the war, that we had to stop it wherever we could. That was a genuine feeling. All around us were people who were running away to Canada to avoid military service. Some of them were doing it for high moral reasons. I am perfectly willing to acknowledge that. Others just, you know, didn't think it was our business and weren't about to get involved. It was quite a division. And coming so soon after the unity, of World War II. Of course, we had the Korean War in between, hadn't we? That was more of a unified national effort, I would say, the Korean War. And based on exactly the same thing, the defeat of communism. And I remember saying to some people who were arguing about whether we had any business being in Vietnam, they said, well, we can't win. And as it turned out, we couldn't. Or we didn't. I'm sure we could have if we'd had a unified national will to do so. But I remember replying to that, yes, but we certainly can lose.
And in retrospect, did we lose, in your opinion?
No. No, there were some very useful things that came out of that. One of the most unuseful was the spread of the use of drugs. That's when it really took off like wildfire, and we're suffering from that till today. That's when it started in Vietnam. So many soldiers had access to the drugs and just got hooked on them.
Did you see that in World War II at all, drug use?
No. Oh, it must have been there, but we were hardly aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
In World War II, when you said drugs, you meant medicine.
Not the same prevalence at all, then.
Abuse would have been alcohol. It's always been, you know, that problem.
Give me your view on some of the other changes that our country and our county have gone through in the time since you've been making these astute observations.
I'm always happy to see young people who have a sense of responsibility to their communities. That's how we were brought up. If you lived in a place, you needed to contribute to the common good. And it didn't make much difference how, as long as you were helping other people. And not just going home to your house in your car, shutting your door, looking at your television, eating your wonderful food, going to work the next day, and paying no attention to the needs and requirements of your neighbors.
How did Harford County stand up to that standard when you got here?
When I got here, there were 39,000 residents, and it was a rural, basically a rural place. Agriculture, in one form or another, was a very large basis of employment, and the proving ground.
Can you describe it to me? What do you remember most about the physical features?
Well, one thing I noticed right away was how more people here had their fences painted than in Virginia, where I grew up. Where there was a lot more, I think it was a combination in Virginia of more poverty and a laxer attitude toward neatness. We are perilously close to the Pennsylvania Dutch ethic and people, and they wouldn't think of having an unpainted fence up there, or an unmown lawn, or a broken barn door. Would they? No. In Virginia, all the time. But we were happy. And we helped each other. It was just quite a different outlook. But now when I go back to Virginia, I cannot help. One of the first things I notice is the lawns are mowed, the fences are mended, the houses are painted. There's not much trash around. I don't know whether it's that Pennsylvania Dutch influence that crept south, or whether they just are more prosperous and see that it is nicer that way.
But Harford County already knew that when you got here.
I was safe. That's right. People were lovely to me. I really appreciated the warm reception that I got as a bride of a native Harford County. I longed for my mountains. I missed those mountains. I ached for them. And we would be riding around the countryside and somebody would say, oh, look at that lovely view. And the view they were talking about consisted of nice pastures and woods and cows grazing. And to me, a view was the Blue Ridge Mountains.
And so describe again, tell me some more details of what you're remembering about Harford County at that time. Mostly pasture. Is that right? It was mostly pasture?
Small communities. They're all still here, mm-hmm. only they're greatly expanded. Falston, for instance, was the main street and those few side streets. A couple of churches, Friends Meeting House. I came in contact with Quakers pretty much for the first time here. There were a few at college, but I really enjoyed knowing them. They seemed like such good people. The Youth Benefit Elementary School had something like 150 students. Now it's got about 1,000, something, or more. Used to be able to ride uptown from here to the courthouse in just a few minutes. You can still ride up there in just a few minutes, but you have 6 traffic lights between you and the courthouse now.
What were the roads like then?
The first time I ever came to my husband's home, this house would view. It was gravel from Route 1 down Toll Gate, down Ring Factory to here. Gravel. And dusty.
And what year was that?
It was 1945.
And then when did the road start to change?
Different times in different places. This one, I can't even remember when, but I think my husband told you in his interview about his mother talking to somebody who was running for office. Yeah, they suffered under those dusty roads. There was a milk stand on the corner of Route 1 and Tollgate Road. And the dairy farmers of the area took their milk up there every morning early and sat around and enjoyed each other's company, waiting for the big tank truck from Baltimore to come and pick it up. And they exchanged news, you know, it was a great meeting every morning.
What was the milk stand? Was it a little structure?
No, it was wooden. It was about... maybe not 6 feet tall, but something like that, perhaps. Wooden. And they just stacked their milk cans on it. They were all marked, of course, with the farmers' names on them.
They'd sit around their trucks and chat with one another.
Mm-hmm. Or get out of the truck. Well, I enjoyed meeting all the agricultural element in the county, because I grew up in an agricultural county myself, even though I was a town girl. My husband's very proud to call himself a countryman. I actually grew up in a town, but surrounded by country.
Can you do a comparison for me of the early Harford County and Harford County now?
Well, the early Harford County, someone else would have to tell you who was here.
Mm-hmm.
My memory goes back only to 1947, and I have had fun telling some people who moved here really recently, within the last 5 years or something like that, and they asked me, was I a native? And I'd say, no, I'm a newcomer. I came in 1947. But from a historical point of view, that is a newcomer. And I, having grown up in a community that was very parochial, even though it was a college town, which expanded its horizons a good bit in one way, still, if you were born there, you know, it was different from being an outsider. You've had that, you know all about that. The interesting thing to me was how many things for the good of the area were accomplished by newcomers.
In Harford County?
Yes, and in our hometown too, so I couldn't be surprised. You know, when you stop and look around, who is it that is doing the League of Women Voters Hospice? The library. The hospital volunteers. Oh, you could go on and on and on, except for you almost always had natives doing things like the Farm Bureau and the, what's that other thing? But much of the community well-being, community improvement effort really was instigated and led by people who moved in from outside. They had known about it where they came from. I think when you live in a place all your life, you do tend to take it more, take it easier and more for granted. I'm not sure, but that could be true.
I know in Lexington, Virginia, where I grew up and I felt, you know, this is my home. People coming in, and there were always people coming in from the outside in a college town like that, which was very good for it. There was always these newcomers who were starting the community theater and the art festivals, you know, all sorts of things. And I think that's true here too. So, just as long as it gets done, it doesn't really matter who does it. It's interesting though. One of the nicest comments about how to live happily in a new place, I heard a young woman say, I sat next to her at dinner very shortly after I moved here, and I asked her how she liked Harford County. I cannot quote her answer, but it involved a beautiful, positive statement about how much she was looking forward to meeting the people here, entering into the life of the community, having her children here. You know, it was not, oh gee, I really miss New Jersey, something awful. Her name is Mignon Cameron, and she married a man who later became Judge Broadnax Cameron. He was Broadnax Cameron all along. He became judge later. He was a lawyer when she married. But I thought that was one lovely attitude about being a bride in a new area. Don't you?
Yes, I do. Is that the attitude you had too, or what was your feeling then?
Well, I think I admired her attitude because it reflected mine.
I suspected that too.
But I didn't say it as nicely as she did.
And so how did you become involved in the community in your early days here?
I grew up with a very strong example before me of my mother. No. She founded a children's clinic. She belonged to a book club. She did a lot. And, you know, I saw her doing these things. And I thought, that's great. That's great. It was the children's clinic she founded was a result of her having been at Johns Hopkins.
Hello? Yes? Would you take a message, please?
Go ahead. The children's clinic was founded where?
Lexington, Virginia, Rockbridge County, Virginia, by my mother. That was a result of her intense interest in child health, which she had gained at Johns Hopkins when she was in nursing school there. She carried that right on. Oh, let's see. She was interested in music, my mother was. So am I. She belonged to a book club. So do I, you know. I belong to FISH. Are you familiar with FISH?
I haven't heard of it.
It's a combination of the churches, mostly. There are a few people in it who are not. They're mostly church people. It's an emergency service, which was started in England back in the 20s. And now, in this county, there is a monthly schedule, and somebody is available on the phone every day. In Aberdeen, Edgewood Joppa, and Bellaire, West Harper, to receive requests for help in food, transportation, medicine, gas and electric bills, whatever is an emergency. I've been doing that because my mother inspired me. She really did. And that's been going for over 35 years in Harford County. And I've been in it since it was founded. And I enjoy a book club I belong to very much.
Was FISH founded in response to specific needs? Or?
Oh, it was for emergency help. It was an English village, I believe. And what they did then was to put a picture of a fish in the window. And then whoever saw it would come in and offer help.
What was the motivation for starting a chapter here in Harford County?
It was the good people of St. Margaret's Roman Catholic Church in Bellaire. They are the ones who really got it started here.
And they saw a need for some sort of civilian assistance service?
Well, I wouldn't say civilian. I would say
non-government, private.
Right, that's it. They, I really admired their Christian commitment to service. And this was just one aspect of it. And once they got it started, others joined in. But it was, my hat is off to St. Margaret's Church people.
Tell me about the time 35 years ago when they saw this need. What were they responding to? What kind of specifics?
I don't know. I was not in on the first meeting. I just joined when asked, when I heard about it. One thing that bothered me, not many things bothered me, but one did. Having just come out of working with the Red Cross with wounded soldiers, very seriously wounded. When I got here, my mother-in-law, whose home this was, very kindly invited me to join the garden club she belonged to. And I went to a meeting of it to see. And at that meeting, the president read a letter that she had received from the director, one of the directors at the Perry Point Veterans Hospital. And the letter said, "We want to help our patients who are able to do so, to have little gardens. We think it would be good therapy for them. They would be carefully screened because Perry Point was a mental hospital. They would be screened. They would have an attendant with them. But what we need are people who know how to garden. So we are putting in a request to your garden club to provide us with members who can come over Tuesday and Friday afternoons from 2 to 4 or something and help our patients. We'll plow up the ground, we'll provide the seeds and the tools and the attendants. Oh, we just need your expertise in gardening. And this group of women voted no because they were very apprehensive to be near mental patients. They did not have confidence that the hospital director would select only those patients who would not harm them. It was understandable, but it made me furious. Having just come from where I'd come from, I couldn't believe that they would turn that down.
So what was your response to them?
I did not join the garden club. I admired many of the accomplishments of the club in years since then. They've done beautiful things. And I have friends among the membership, certainly. But I just couldn't. And they never asked me again.
And maybe Perry Point never got its gardens either.
I hope they did. I hope they did. I hope that director over there was persevering, and maybe he turned to the garden club of Cecil County, if there was one. It's a very, very tough life to be in charge of mental patients who are hospitalized permanently. Very tough. You can imagine, I'm sure. I can't.
We know it's so. It's difficult. Do you remember anything else from your early time here of adjusting to your new role?
Missing the mountains, I said. I thought the roads were very bumpy and curvy, which proves that the state of Virginia had a good road system even in those days. They were very proud of their road system. And my mother, who was totally social conscience oriented, rather than creature comforts oriented, used to speak scornfully of the state of Virginia for putting more money into roads than they did in hospitals and schools, which she thought was the limit.
Yeah, I can certainly sort of understand that. And you raised your children here in Harford County?
Right here in this house.
What was it like for your children to grow up here? What were their school situations like?
The schools were fine. I was a great believer in public education, having been a product of that myself, and yet I had 2 or 3 years in a private school along the way before I graduated from high school. But every parent has to decide if that's your attitude, if you are a strong believer in public education, and you better be, because it educates, 98% of the children in the county. If you are a believer in it, then you've got to decide, are you going to put your children into it? Is it good enough for your children? You have to ask yourself. Are you going to sacrifice yourself on the altar of a principle? Every conscientious, educated parent needs to ask himself this question. And our children went for six, right straight through sixth grades here in Harford County. And then my husband felt so strongly that he wanted to give them the very best he could. He transported them to private schools in Baltimore, Gilman and Bryn Mawr. Year after year after year, he drove them in there, and then the mothers took turns bringing them home. And they certainly did learn to write well there. And they learned, had fine, basic schooling. They lost some things by going in there, which I think, because I'm prejudiced in favor of my children, I think they have compensated for pretty well. I said to him, if they start showing any signs of snobbishness, they are going to be taken out of those private schools so fast it's going to make their heads spin. And they didn't, so we didn't. But I was watching for it all the time. It was hard for them, though, to have their friends there, you know, this cut-up life.
So if you had one thing to say about your time in Harford County, what would it be? One overall?